Well, this one, which may be familiar. And there's another example of the same thing already in existence. If you follow the Archigram people, you know all about Krishikal. Extension of the human body like an overcoat, which one day in the future we'll be able to control our environment in a very sophisticated kind of way. There are already machines like this in which people have lived for almost a year underwater. They've just gone to the moon and back in that same kind of machine. These are not futurist examples. They're simple extensions of what we have. They're very linear progressions. It's one of my favorites. Maybe you've seen the Walking City one. Futurist architecture. That's a machine that's been walking around the Arctic with 10 men in it for over 10 years now. How futurist are these visions? Again, one of the more favorite ones. And if you translate that, it's just some fancy graphics on habitat, isn't it? So how far all these changes have been taking us? We haven't made the image shift. We're still looking at the star and haven't reorganized our equipment. One of the really nice things to look at in this context of how distorted your image can get based on preconception is the robot. That's a 19th century drawing of what a robot might look like.
It's particularly nice in the sense that the smoking and the whole fifth, they not only built a model of the human being as the robot, but it has all the human frailties, at least some of the human frailties. And we've been building robots like that, that try to simulate what people do it with a little bit of leverage and a little more. An extension, there's the same kind of tube the 19th century thing had as a control. It's outside the human body, a robot that moves off by itself. Probably everybody's worked on one at once. This is one that we developed for the Boeing company. Builds radio towers. Climbs up the tower, takes the struts out of its back and builds this radio tower. You know, try to figure out what to do with it when it gets to the top. Probably take it off with a helicopter because it has my the TV camera watches what the hands are doing and moves up. It's trying to reconstruct the individual. A lot of what we're doing in architecture is doing that. We're trying to reconstruct people. Here's a much more interesting thing. This is a prototype that was made about 5 years ago by General Electric for something they call the exoskeleton. The framework you strap on looks something like this when it's on a man. It's run by a battery pack. If you notice, there's a metal framework up to the arms, on the arms and legs. The motion of this is controlled by the man. There's no remote control in this. It works the way an automatic door opener or closer works. If you've ever been with department store doors, office doors that are heavy, have this. As you touch it, you make the motion of opening the door and the machine picks it up and does the rest. The man wearing this, and you can buy these now for about $1,500. The man wearing this can lift over 1,000 pounds and you walk down the block with it. You ever seen the kind of things we use when we pave street sprints? You ever seen a backhoe try to lift a curbstone out of the ground and move it? Incredibly clumsy operation when a man with one of these things can just lift it up and walk. I was in a mobile home factory the other day where each time one of the houses had to move down the line, four men came and picked it up and moved it down the line. It's really a much more sophisticated kind of robot than this. This is a way to apply tools to amplify a human being, to take human motions and simply extend them rather than to try to recreate them and abstract them. So our image of a robot, the mechanical man, may be much more our image of the robot, the man with a heart pacing. That's a kind of robot too. Much more subtle, sophisticated kind of robot. But just as some of the forms that are going to come out of building may be more subtle and sophisticated than what we thought about, some of the tools we're going to use are likely to be much more subtle and sophisticated. Let's look at some other forms of switch that we're not using. Maybe you recognize Saarinen's terminal at Kennedy Airport for TWA. It's an example of a fairly advanced stage in architecture. It's made to look like a bird flying, to represent the airline in motion and all of that. So when I look at the other side of the image shift, switch it from the star to the cubes, look at Solomon's next building, which doesn't try to look like a building moving, but is actually a building moving. There's a world of difference between these two buildings, because here at Dulles, the building moves out in terms of this bus to the airplane and actually becomes a moving building. There's a great difference here. There's a beginning of a conceptual shift in that kind of thing. Houses are one of the best examples to look at in this thing, in houses. Well, that's most people's image of a house. The American dream. Structure and chimneys and windows. What is a house really? Have you thought about it much? That's the drawing we had made to show what a house really is if you count what you're paying for. Those are just the mechanical systems of the house. And if you add those up, they cost way more than the structure that you think about. Yeah, these are all hacked in piecemeal into a conception of the framework that comes from another century. And these are just squeezed in the spaces that are left over when it's all over. This may not be clear, so we have more clear. Take a look at some of this equipment. Would house be a home without hi-fi, stereo, refrigerator? These are all equipment that's come on the scene since the house took form. What's been the impact of all of these things on the house? Or in a more colorful way, there's the American dream, isn't it? That's all house. That's what you think of when you think of house. Yet how much of this is included in our concept of a house? As a matter of fact, think of the confusion of it. This one's in the mortgage. Maybe that one's in the mortgage. That's not in the mortgage. These things aren't. What's in the house and what's not? What's furniture and what's the house? Where does the person begin and the house end? And where does the community and the individual change or shift? And whoever thinks of these things as the beginning of a house, except the housewife that everyone makes fun of, as a matter of fact, these have become very much a part of our lives. And they're stuck into an image of a house that comes from another world. What's the result of it? Well, we get a lot of confusing images that emerge when we begin to try to patch the two things together. That's a Berkeley apartment house I took a picture of the other day. Nice new metal windows. Fake bark on the outside of a stucco building. These bolts were epoxied on. I watched them one day epoxying all those bolts on the outside. Isn't that really what we're doing with most of our buildings today? So hacking together old images and sort of romantic notions about what we are and what we'd like to have together with a new piece of technology as it happens to do the job a little better. It's a little bit like this picture I found in an old New York Times magazine. The fuzzy interface, the conflict between old and new and the romanticism of one lifestyle together with a new emerging technology. That's not really as good as this one, which is my favorite of all. That was one of the entries in the 1920s Chicago Tribune competition. Isn't that what we're doing with most of our architecture today? We're trying to fit a new kind of building into a traditional form. And it doesn't work. The interface is fuzzy, the mismatch is a mishmash. Let's look at housing a little more carefully, because that's one of the more interesting. Come back to our old friend. As we said, that's what most Americans, at any rate, think of when they think of home. That's what most architects think of when they think of housing, houses, homes. And that's what we're building. Another example of a very fuzzy correlation between what we're doing and what we're talking about. That's a housing project in New York City. It wasn't quite completed yet, a middle-income project. More and more of our architecture is as confused as this is. And for most of the world, we're not even reaching them in terms of any kind of architecture. This is what housing means for a great majority of the people in the world today. In the islands, in Africa, in Mississippi. While we're involved in our romanticisms, whether we're architects or housewives, that's what housing is for most people. When the government comes in with the power of the architectural profession behind it, and we build slum clear urban renewal, we get things like this in New York City. Or like this one, the Luna Park houses on the site of the amusement park at Coney Island. As a matter of fact, several years ago, we asked some of the children who lived in this row of houses in Harlem in New York if they draw a picture of New York City. And this is one of the pictures they drew. As we live in these houses, the result of our misconception about what we are and where we're going, the result is destruction and violence and a great unhappiness with the total environment. So what can we do about it? The people who are involved in the production of houses, the answer seems quite clear. We're not producing houses in a reasonable way. Here's a picture of the building of the Tower of Babel. Recognize any of the things going on there? Or to put it another way, is there a single job you see going on in there?
The pulley, the hammer, the sword, the axe man.
Any of these jobs foreign to a construction site today? They say that if a Babylonian carpenter arrived on a union job anywhere in the United States today with his toolbox, he'd get right to work and earn his wages just as well as anyone else on the site. Obviously, we think if we could begin to produce houses in a more rational way and take advantage of some of the enormous changes that have happened in the rest of technology, we could begin to eliminate a lot of this mismatch. We could begin to operate from a position of strength rather than weakness. Look at some more examples of where we are in terms of construction. That's a picture that was taken on the 60th floor of the Chase Manhattan Bank building when it was under construction. Modern technology, it worked for a modern institution. Does it look familiar? Maybe you see in some of these pictures of a Roman building project the kind of operation that's going on in most construction phases. Look at what they're doing and compare it with these guys at the Chase Manhattan Bank. Or look at the 80s and our friends at the Chase Manhattan Bank. Or the Myers, actually. And once again, our friends at the bank. Modern technology and the most advanced technological nation in the world is building houses like this. Now, if you really have a sharp eye, you realize this is a pretty advanced kind of construction. You notice mechanical shoring instead of simple wooden supports. Can't find too much more there. It's pretty typical. Let's look what it represents in terms of waste and mismanagement. How much of the material that arrives at this site leaves as junk rather than going into the building? What's the implication of all that waste? The implication of this kind of mess and how long it exists in the city? Let's look more deeply into this. We'll get deeper and deeper into the problem of housing. This is a reconstruction of a house that existed on the Palatine Hill in Rome over 2,000 years ago. Construction look familiar? Look at these Gothic carpenters working. Not very much has changed in those years, has it? Victorian carpenters? Or a typical American subdivision today? The whole process doesn't seem to have been affected by any of the other changes that have gone on in our society. And what's the result? There's a typical house that's the product of that. You may not like that too much. Okay. There are always a couple of meek people in the crowd who like to see detail. Sorry, I could throw this one in. These houses are selling for $50,000.
On a clear day, you can
see forever. But why is it that the building industry is doing this kind of thing? Other industries have been industrialized for more than a century. That's a picture of a machine that was patented in 1882 to slaughter hogs in a more efficient way than they ever did before.
We're all familiar with the way automobiles are made. There's a GM plant in Fremont, California, that turns out a car every 15 seconds. If you've ever seen a modern automobile plant, I'm afraid it'll crush many of your illusions about the standardized product. The Fremont plant here makes almost the whole General Motors line on the single production line. They make Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, and Buick. They make two-doors, four-doors, hardtops, convertibles, and station wagons. And they make them in a completely random system, coming through one after the other. You get a blue Pontiac two-door and a green Chevrolet convertible every 15 seconds. It's fine. We're all familiar with the Volkswagen kind of operation. How, in fact, one enormous machine begins with raw material and ends up turning out a car. The whole operation from one end to the other takes 15 hours. But look at still another example of how industry operates outside of buildings. That's the Austin facility outside of Seattle where the Boeing 747 is under construction. At the height of production, one of these comes out the door every 2.5 days. If you stand it on end, it's a 25-story building. It holds 500 people, has about 15 bathrooms, 4 kitchens, and it flies close to the speed of sound. Who do we know who can build an office building every 2.5 days? Very similar kind of construction. Obviously, there are many tools and techniques that we can learn from this. Just in case you forgot what we're doing back at the ranch. Put this in every once in a while. But let's just say it's really not fair to pick selective examples and we leave out what the building industry is doing. Because, in fact, the building industry has become industrialized, hasn't it? Tends to turn out products like this very often. But they're made in a factory. Here's a typical factory of the kind that has been quite successful in the last few years. Based on the contents of our miscellaneous file, by now you're sophisticated enough to recognize this is a clock mechanism, not a cloud. There's some big advances in here. If you notice, what's going on is the same kind of carpentry operation that our Babylonian friends were involved with. But there are a couple of things that a sharp eye will show you is quite different. Look at that sheet of plywood. Excuse me. You don't see those in an ordinary lumberyard. And only a company that produces a large enough number of these units can order those by the carload and save all the problem of making joints. As a matter of fact, what they do is spread it out and they cut the holes for the windows so there's no joints in the whole thing and no problem with leakage. That's a fairly sophisticated technology turning out these buildings. Product is not very sophisticated. As a matter of fact, what we've done is apply new techniques to turning out traditional buildings. These are the Fidelia Village project of Magnolia Homes. It was one of the low-income housing demonstrations. That's the final product. You don't like that? Same factory made these boxes. In fact, this is one of the working drawings. For the Puffin Village project in Amherst, Massachusetts. Like those better? There is control over this kind of operation. As a matter of fact, there have been a number of proposals to show that you can do more with this kind of operation than simply build one and two family houses. Maybe you recognize that from one of Corbusier's books. Wouldn't it be nice if we could make houses like an enormous chest of drawers and slide the units in, make these in a kind of housing factory and slip them in? Saul Steinberg puts it more colorfully, I think. City of the future. And as a matter of fact, architects are not far behind. Here's a prototype made for the Jones and Loughlin Steel Company. They're building some of these. If you've seen pictures or been to the Japanese exhibition last summer, you saw there were buildings made exactly like this. And there are a number of projects of that sort. When I was at school, everyone's thesis looked like that.
futuristic architecture. We have lots of those now. This is the Zachary Corporation building the San Antonio Hill. In each one of these cases, though, what we're doing is mass producing, manufacturing in a factory, a standardized product that at best from the spatial architectural point of view, not quite as good as what we were used to in the 19th century. More equipment, better level of services, but basically from the architectural point of view, from the living point of view, extremely restrictive. This is one of the winners of the breakthrough competition. Does a similar kind of thing, making half shells and combining them. Just to show you all very often, this is our system in the breakthrough competition. These are wound fiberglass boxes that are stacked in this kind of framework. Not bad if you're in my living room. So an egg crate kind of thing. But one of the problems with this, as you see, is that you can stack them easily. You can't do very much in terms of the spatial organization. And in fact, that's pretty much where we are today. We can mass produce old-fashioned houses, carry them around and place them with a really modern technology. Let's try to look at the other side of the picture for a minute. What we've been looking at is a star. But I'd like to try to show you in the next few pictures of what some of the elements of the cube might be, and where, in terms of industrialized building, we might begin to develop initial models. Let's look for a minute at some of the pieces that are produced by modern industry, even though they're not absorbed in the new stage of the final product. Try to show the great deal of hidden industrial input in the most ordinary building product today. The kind of operations that you see listed here were the common operations on the building site in terms of building a window at the end of the Second World War. You're probably all familiar with that kind of operation. Someone came and put the sash in, glazer came and put the glass in, painter did the painting, someone else trimmed or finished or shimmed. A whole series of operations that took place on the site with tools on the window. As we began to understand the wastefulness of that kind of operation, in particular the problem of coordinating all that on the site, more and more of the operations were combined so that not long after we found we could make the whole frame in the factory and then just assemble the glass and put it in, so we sort of telescoped the whole operation. And if you've watched the recent building operation, see that what happens is someone brings a whole window, glass, moving parts, pre-finished, four bolts put the whole thing in. In the sense, in these few years since the end of the Second World War, most of the building has changed very quietly without changing its form at all, but it's changed from a craft to an erection operation. Typical of most building operations today, it's an assembly operation, not a craft operation. There are a number of products like that. These are precast wall panels made in a factory. A lot of industrial input comes to the site and are put together this way. And some of the earliest products of this sort were structural elements like these shop baton elements that were made in Holland by the late 40s. In a more sophisticated way, they were used by Louis Kahn and his laboratories in Philadelphia. You see the precast elements, very similar to the ones you just saw that were factory made 50 miles away in Carter's site. Another building that was made in the same factory, Philadelphia Police Station, there you see three-story high wall panel that was made at a factory in another state, and the whole building was assembled as this kind of package. Remember our old friend, even here, the window is an industrial product, a kind of total product that didn't exist before the Second World. In fact, all the plywood sheeting is a new industrial product. plywood as a building material, and that didn't come into general use until the late 40s. There are any number of hidden industrial inputs in this sort of thing, which are waiting to be organized into a new form. One of my favorites, that's a building track under construction in California. Those are prefabricated chimneys. They say that great architecture makes great ruins. You see, there's a great possibility. Because of a jurisdictional fight with the prefabricated chimney people and all the other labor unions, they assembled all the chimneys for 500 houses in this field. And those people left before the union labor came to do the rest of the house. You see, all the chimneys are standing there. If you look around us, you see a number of other hidden industrial inputs. Plastic pipe in the first place, but all pre-made plumbing assemblies that were just set up there. These are metal studs that are supported on jacks very much like a car jack instead of having concrete pews in the foundation. Any number of new innovations that are in there, but because we haven't had the image shift yet, they're simply absorbed into the star rather than into the cubes. We have just putting them into the miscellaneous pile at this point. They're ready to be picked out of the miscellaneous pile and used in a better way. There's one of the clearest examples of this kind of image shift. That's a Westinghouse factory that's making dishwashers. Clothes washers. What's impressive here is not the quantity. Obviously, if you're used to dealing with building industry quantities in the normal sense, the number of these things and the way they're moving through here is impressive. On the other hand, this is the building industry. There's more money in your house going to this kind of thing probably than there is with the structure. But the other interesting thing is to look at some of the aspects of this. You can hook the plumbing of this thing up yourself. You just snap it on. What's different about a clothes washer from a kitchen sink so that the plumber has to come with all his welding and soldering and brazing equipment to attach your kitchen sink when you could just snap this hose in? Why do you need a vent that goes through the roof of your house for the kitchen sink when this machine is vented right under the sink? There is implied in the kind of industrial input in here a whole new way to look at buildings, the basis for a whole set of tools. Let's look at a few more of these diagrams and see how some of the other things in buildings have changed. This sums up what seemed a very logical kind of combination, particularly to some of the people working on the problem of rehousing in Europe right after the war. We could put all those miscellaneous steps together, move them from the site to the factory. We could make incredible improvements on the way that, and the time that a building was put up. This is the basis of the concrete panel buildings that have formed a good part of the rebuilding in Europe since the war. Panel is made in the factory that includes inside and outside finish, insulation, fireproofing, acoustic insulation, windows, doors, just about anything you want. There's a Danish system making a row house development with that kind of system. That panel has brick on the outside, concrete on the inside. Made in a factory very similar to this. This is the Jespersen factory in Copenhagen. About as close to a mass production automated process as you'll ever see. Here you see the forms moving across the factory floor. They move at a rate of about one every 2 minutes. First guy's cleaning out the form that's just been stripped of its glass panel. The next people are putting the reinforcing steel in. It moves down the line to the casting bed here. You see the little truck comes by gravity from the batching plant, dumps the concrete into this. Machine rolls back and forth over the panel, spreading the concrete and compacting it. Lifts up and it moves on to the next station. They move by into the room behind where the steam cured. About 4 hours later, the panel is stripped and the form goes through a second time around. There's some of the products of that factory. These are floor panels made by Jespersen. This particular yard is in England, because one of the things you could do with this kind of system is export it very easily.
And the Esperson people sell a license to do this thing all over the world. So you see buildings in England being constructed with this. Many of the operations that were done piecemeal, scattered, disorganized, can be organized in a better way in this kind of system. So you see, as each floor is finished, the building is completely enclosed. There's no need to work on the outside of this building with scaffolding. There's no danger that things inside will get wet. As a matter of fact, a floor of this is put up in less than a week, and in 4 weeks the whole building is enclosed. Once it's enclosed, the finishing work can go on. As a matter of fact, the finishing work can begin on the lower floors as it's going on. Some more examples of that kind of building, you see that industrial process has helped to make a whole set of new kinds of building pieces. They have pieces that very much belong in our miscellaneous file. Outside, inside pieces, finished pieces that are also structural, a whole series of combinations that didn't exist before. But they're being put into buildings in a very conventional way. It's a pretty ordinary kind of building when it's finished.